Chapter 2 The Shadow. Ged had thought that as the prentice of a great mage he would enter at once into the mystery and mastery of power. He would understand the language of the beasts and the speech of the leaves of the forest, he thought, and sway the winds with his word, and learn to change himself into any shape he wished. Maybe he and his master would run together as stags, or fly to Rhaelbi over the mountain on the wings of eagles. But it was not so at all. They wandered, first down into the vale, and then gradually south and westward around the mountain, giving lodging in little villages or spending the night out in the wilderness, like poor journeymen sorcerers, or tinkers, or beggars. They entered no mysterious domain. Nothing happened. The mage's oaken staff that Ged had watched at first with eager dread was nothing but a stout staff to walk with. 3 days went by, and 4 days went by, and still Ogion hadn't spoken a single charm in Ged's hearing, and hadn't taught him a single name or rune or spell. Though a very silent man, he was so mild and calm that Ged soon lost his awe of him, and in a day or two more he was bold enough to ask his master, "When will my apprenticeship begin, sir?"
"It has begun," said Ogion.
There was a silence, as if Ged was keeping back something he had to say. Then he said it.
"But I haven't learned anything yet."
"Because you haven't found out what I'm teaching," replied the mage, going on at his steady, long-legged pace along their road, which was the high pass between Ovark and Wiss.
He was a dark man, like most Gauntish men, dark copper-brown, grey-haired, lean and tough as a hound, tireless. He spoke seldom, ate little, slept less. His eyes and ears were very keen, and often there was a listening look on his face. Ged didn't answer him. It's not always easy to answer a mage.
"You want to work spells," Ogion said presently, striding along. "You've drawn too much water from that well. Wait. Manhood is patience. Mastery is 9 times patience. What is that herb by the path?"
"Straw flower."
"And that?"
"I don't know."
"Fourfoil, they call it."
Ogion had halted, the copper-shod foot of his staff near the little weed, so Ged looked closely at the plant, and plucked a dry seed-pod from it, and finally asked, since Ogion said nothing more, "What is its use, master?"
"None I know of."
Ged kept the seed-pod a while as they went on, then tossed it away.
"When you know the fourfoil in all its seasons, root and leaf and flower, by sight and scent and seed, then you may learn its true name, knowing its being, which is more than its use. What, after all, is the use of you, or of myself? Is Gaunt Mountain useful, or the open sea?"
Ogion went on a half mile or so, and said at last,
"To hear, one must be silent."
The boy frowned. He didn't like to be made to feel a fool. He kept back his resentment and impatience, and tried to be obedient, so that Ogion would consent at last to teach him something, for he hungered to learn, to gain power. It began to seem to him, though, that he could have learned more walking with any herb-gatherer or village sorcerer, and as they went round the mountain westward into the lonely forests past Wiss, he wondered more and more what was the greatness and the magic of this great mage Ogion. For when it rained, Ogion wouldn't even say the spell that every weather-worker knows, to send the storm aside. In a land where sorcerers come thick, like Gaunt or the Enlades, You may see a rain-cloud blundering slowly from side to side and place to place, as one spell shunts it on to the next, till at last it is buffeted out over the sea where it can rain in peace. But a giant let the rain fall where it would. He found a thick fir-tree and lay down beneath it. Ged crouched among the dripping bushes, wet and sullen, and wondered what was the good of having power if you were too wise to use it, and wished he had gone as prentice to that old weather-worker of the Vale, where at least he would have slept dry. He didn't speak any of his thoughts aloud. He said not a word. His master smiled, and fell asleep in the rain. Along toward sunreturn, when the first heavy snows began to fall in the heights of Gaunt, they came to Rhea Albi, O'Giant's home. It is a town on the edge of the high rocks of Overfell, and its name means Falcon's Nest. From it one can see far below the deep harbour and the towers of the port of Gaunt, and the ships that go in and out of the gate of the bay between the armed cliffs. And far to the west across the sea one may make out the blue hills of Oronea, easternmost of the Inward Isles. The Major's house, though large and soundly built of timber, with hearth and chimney rather than a fire-pit, was like the huts of Tenalder's village, all one room, with a goat-shed built onto one side. There was a kind of alcove in the west wall of the room, where Ged slept. Over his pallet was a window that looked out on the sea, but most often the shutters must be closed against the great winds that blew all winter from the west and north. In the dark warmth of that house, Ged spent the winter, hearing the rush of rain and wind outside, or the silence of snowfall, learning to write and read the 600 runes of Hardik. Very glad he was to learn this lore, for without it no mere rote learning of charms and spells will give a man true mastery. The Hardik tongue of the archipelago, though it has no more magic power in it than any other tongue of men, has its roots in the old speech, that language in which things are named with their true names, and the way to the understanding of this speech starts with the runes that were written when the islands of the world first were raised up from the sea. Still no marvels and enchantments occurred. All winter there was nothing but the heavy pages of the rune-book turning, and the rain and the snow falling, and O'Gian would come in from roaming the icy forests or from looking after his goats, and stamp the snow off his boots, and sit down in silence by the fire. And the Major's long, listening silence would fill the room, and fill Ged's mind, until sometimes it seemed he had forgotten what words sounded like. And when O'Gian spoke at last, it was as if he had, just then and for the first time, invented speech. Yet the words he spoke were no great matters, but had to do only with simple things, bread and water and weather and sleep. As the spring came on, quick and bright, O'Gian often sent Ged forth to gather herbs on the meadows above Rhea Albi, and told him to take as long as he liked about it, giving him freedom to spend all day wandering by rain-filled streams and through the woods and over wet green fields in the sun. Ged went with delight each time, and stayed out till night, but he didn't entirely forget the herbs. He kept an eye out for them, while he climbed and roamed and waded and explored, and always brought some home. He came on a meadow between two streams where the flower called white hallows grew thick, and as these blossoms are rare and prized by healers, he came back again next day. Someone else was there before him, a girl, whom he knew by sight as the daughter of the old lord of Rhea Albi. He wouldn't have spoken to her, but she came to him and greeted him pleasantly. "I know you. You are the Sparrowhawk, our Major's adept. I wish you would tell me about sorcery." He looked down at the white flowers that brushed against her white skirt, and at first he was shy and glum and hardly answered. But she went on talking in an open, careless, wilful way that little by little set him at ease. She was a tall girl of about his own age, very sallow, almost white-skinned. Her mother, they said in the village, was from Oskil, or some such foreign land. Her hair fell long and straight, like a fall of black water. Ged thought her very ugly, but he had a desire to please her, to win her admiration, that drew on him as they talked. She made him tell all the story of his tricks with the mist that had defeated the Kargish warriors, and she listened as if she wondered and admired, but she spoke no praise. And soon she was off on another tack. "Can you call the birds and beasts to you?" she asked. "I can," said Ged. He knew there was a falcon's nest in the cliffs above the meadow, and he summoned the bird by its name. It came, but it wouldn't light on his wrist, being put off, no doubt, by the girl's presence. It screamed and struck the air with broad, barred wings, and rose up on the wind.
"What do you call that kind of charm that made the falcon come?"
"A spell of summoning."
"Can you call the spirits of the dead to come to you, too?"
He thought she was mocking him with this question, because the falcon had not fully obeyed his summons. He wouldn't let her mock him.
"I might if I chose," he said in a calm voice. "Is it not very difficult, very dangerous, to summon a spirit?"
"Difficult? Yes. Dangerous?" he shrugged.
This time he was almost certain there was admiration in her eyes.
"Can you make a love charm?"
"That is no mastery."
"True," says she. "Any village witch can do it. Can you do changing spells? Can you change your own shape, as wizards do, they say?"
Again he wasn't quite sure that she didn't ask the question mockingly, and so again he replied, "I might if I chose." She began to beg him to transform himself into anything he wished, a hawk, a bull, a fire, a tree. He put her off with short, secretive words, such as his master used, but he didn't know how to refuse flatly when she coaxed him. And besides, he didn't know whether he himself believed his boast or not. He left her, saying that his master, the mage, expected him at home, and he didn't come back to the meadow the next day. But the day after he came again, saying to himself that he should gather more of the flowers while they bloomed. She was there, and together they waded barefoot in the boggy grass, pulling the heavy white hallow blooms. The sun of spring shone, and she talked with him as merrily as any goat-herd lass of his own village. She asked him again about sorcery, and listened wide-eyed to all he told her, so that he fell to boasting again. Then she asked him if he wouldn't work a changing spell, and when he put her off, she looked at him, putting back the black hair from her face, and said,
"Are you afraid to do it?"
"No, I'm not afraid." She smiled a little disdainfully and said, "Maybe you're too young." That he would not endure. He didn't say much, but he resolved that he would prove himself to her. He told her to come back again to the meadow tomorrow, if she liked, and so took leave of her, and came back to the house while his master was still out. He went straight to the shelf and took down the two law books, which Ogion had never yet opened in his presence. He looked for a spell of self-transformation, but being slow to read the runes yet, and understanding little of what he read, he couldn't find what he sought. These books were very ancient, Ogion having them from his own master, Heleth Farseer, and Heleth from his master, the mage of Perigal, and so back into the times of myth. Small and strange was the writing, overwritten and interlined by many hands, and all those hands were dust now. yet here and there Ged understood something of what he tried to read, and with the girl's questions and her mockery always in his mind, he stopped on a page that bore a spell of summoning up the spirits of the dead. As he read it, puzzling out the runes and symbols one by one, a horror came over him. His eyes were fixed, and he couldn't lift them till he had finished reading all the spell. Then, raising his head, he saw it was dark in the house. He had been reading without any light in the darkness. He couldn't now make out the runes when he looked down at the book. Yet the horror grew in him, seeming to hold him bound in his chair. He was cold. Looking over his shoulder, he saw that something was crouching beside the closed door, a shapeless clot of shadow, darker than the darkness. It seemed to reach out towards him, and to whisper, and to call to him in a whisper, but he couldn't understand the words. The door was flung wide. A man entered with a white light flaming about him, a great bright figure who spoke aloud, fiercely and suddenly. The darkness and the whispering ceased and were dispelled. The horror went out of Ged, but still he was mortally afraid, for it was a giant, the mage, who stood there in the doorway with a brightness all about him, and the oaken staff in his hand burned with a white radiance. Saying no word, the mage came past Ged and lighted the lamp and put the books away on their shelf. Then he turned to the boy and said, "You will never work that spell, but in peril of your power and your life. Was it for that spell you opened the books?" "No, master," the boy murmured, and shamefully he told a giant what he had sought, and why. "You don't remember what I told you, that that girl's mother, the lord's wife, is an enchantress?" Indeed, a giant had once said this, but Ged hadn't paid much attention, though he knew by now that a giant never told him anything that he hadn't good reason to tell him. "The girl herself is half a witch already. It may be the mother who sent the girl to talk to you. It may be she who opened the book to the page you read. The powers she serves are not the powers I serve. I don't know her will, but I know she does not will me well. Ged, listen to me now. Have you never thought how danger must surround power as shadow does light? This sorcery is not a game we play for pleasure or for praise. Think of this, that every word, every act of our art is said and is done either for good or for evil. Before you speak or do, you must know the price that is to pay." Driven by his shame, Ged cried, "How am I to know these things when you teach me nothing? Since I live with you, I've done nothing, seen nothing." "Now you have seen something," said the mage, "by the door, in the darkness, when I came in." Ged was silent. Ogion knelt down and built the fire on the hearth and lit it, for the house was cold. Then, still kneeling, he said in his quiet voice, "Ged, my young falcon, you're not bound to me or to my service. You didn't come to me, but I to you. You're very young to make this choice, but I can't make it for you. If you wish, I'll send you to Roke Island, where all high arts are taught. Any craft you undertake to learn, you will learn, for your power is great, greater even than your pride, I hope. I would keep you here with me, for what I have is what you lack. But I will not keep you against your will. Now choose between Realby and Roke." Ged stood dumb, his heart bewildered. He had come to love this man Ogion, who had healed him with a touch, and who had no anger. He loved him, and he hadn't known it until now. He looked at the oaken staff leaning in the chimney corner, remembering the radiance of it that had burned out evil from the dark, and he yearned to stay with Ogion, to go wandering through the forest with him, long and far, learning how to be silent. Yet other cravings were in him that would not be stilled, the wish for glory, the will to act. Ogion seemed a long road towards mastery, a slow by-path to follow, when he might go sailing before the sea-winds straight to the inmost sea, to the Isle of the Wise, where the air was bright with enchantments, and the Archmage walked amidst wonders. "Master," he said, "I will go to Roke." So a few days later, on a sunny morning of spring, Ogion strode beside him down the steep road from the Overfell, 15 miles to the great port of Gaunt. There, at the land-gate between carven dragons, the guards of the city of Gaunt, seeing the mage, knelt with bared swords and welcomed him. They knew him, and did him honour by the prince's order and their own will, for 10 years ago Ogion had saved the city from earthquake that would have shaken the towers of the rich down to the ground and closed the channel of the armed cliffs with avalanche. He had spoken to the mountain of Gaunt, calming it, and had stilled the trembling precipices of the Overfell as one soothes a frightened beast. Ged had heard some talk of this, and now, wondering to see the armed guardsman kneel to his quiet master, he remembered it. He glanced up almost in fear at this man who had stopped an earthquake, but Ogion's face was quiet as always. They went down to the quays, where the harbour master came hastening to welcome Ogion and ask what service he might do. The mage told him, and at once he named a ship bound for the inmost sea, aboard which Ged might go as passenger. "Or they will take him as windbringer," he said. "If he has the craft, they have no weather-worker aboard." "He has some skill with mist and fog, but none with sea-winds," the maid said, putting his hand lightly on Ged's shoulder. "Do not try any tricks with the sea and the winds of the sea, Sparrowhawk. You are a landsman still. Harbour-master, what is the ship's name?"
"Shadow. From the Andrades, bound to Hort Town with furs and ivories. A good ship, Master Ogion."
The mage's face darkened at the name of the ship, but he said, "So be it. Give this writing to the warden of the school on Roke, Sparrowhawk. Go with a fair wind. Farewell." That was all his parting. He turned away and went striding up the street away from the quays. Ged stood forlorn and watched his master go. "Come along, lad," said the harbour master, and took him down the waterfront to the pier, where Shadow was making ready to sail. It might seem strange that on an island 50 miles wide, in a village under cliffs that stare out forever on the sea, a child may grow to manhood, never having stepped in a boat or dipped his finger in salt water. But so it is. Farmer, goat-herd, cattle-herd, hunter or artisan, the landsman looks at the ocean as at a salt, unsteady realm that has nothing to do with him at all. The village, 2 days' walk from his village, is a foreign land, and the island, a day's sail from his island, is a mere rumour, misty hills seen across the water, not solid ground like that he walks on. So to Ged, who had never been down from the heights of the mountain, the port of Gaunt was an awesome and marvellous place. The great houses and towers of cut stone and waterfront of piers and docks and basins and moorages, the seaport where 50 boats and galleys rocked at quayside, or lay hauled up and overturned for repairs, or stood out at anchor in the roadstead with furled sails and closed oar-ports. The sailors shouting in strange dialects,
and the longshoremen running heavy laden amongst barrels and boxes and coils of rope and stacks of oars, the bearded merchants in furred robes conversing quietly as they picked their way along the slimy stones above the water, the fishermen unloading their catch, coopers pounding and shipmakers hammering and clam-sellers singing and shipmasters bellowing, and beyond all the silent, shining bay. With eyes and ears and mind bewildered, he followed the harbour-master to the broad dock where Shadow was tied up, and the harbour-master brought him to the master of the ship. With few words spoken, the ship's master agreed to take Gedda's passenger to Roke, since it was a mage that asked it, and the harbour-master left the boy with him. The master of the Shadow was a big man, and fat, in a red cloak trimmed with pelowi fur, such as Andradean merchants wear. He never looked at Ged, but asked him in a mighty voice,
"Can you work weather, boy?"
"I can."
"Can you bring the wind?"
He had to say he couldn't, and with that the master told him to find a place out of the way and stay in it. The oarsmen were coming aboard now, for the ship was to go out into the roadstead before night fell, and sail with the ebb tide near dawn. There was no place out of the way, but Ged climbed up as well as he could onto the bundled, lashed, and hide-covered cargo in the stern of the ship, and clinging there, watched all that passed. The oarsmen came leaping aboard, sturdy men with great arms, while longshoremen rolled water barrels thundering out the dock and stowed them under the rowers' benches. The well-built ship rode low with her burden, yet danced a little on the lapping shore waves, ready to be gone. Then the steersman took his place at the right of the sternpost, looking forward to the ship's master, who stood on a plank let in at the jointure of the keel with the stem, which was carved as the old serpent of Andrat. The master roared his orders hugely, and Shadow was untied and towed clear of the docks by two labouring rowboats. Then the master's roar was,
"Open ports!"
And the great oars shot rattling out, 15 to a side. The rowers bent their strong backs, while a lad up beside the master beat the stroke on a drum. Easy as a gull oared by her wings, the ship went now, and the noise and hurly-burly of the city fell away suddenly behind. They came out in the silence of the waters of the bay, and over them rose the white peak of the mountain, seeming to hang above the sea. In a shallow creek in the lee of the southern armed cliff, the anchor was thrown over, and there they rode the night. Of the 70 crewmen of the ship, some were like Ged, very young in years, though all had made their passage into manhood. These lads called him over to share food and drink with them, and were friendly, though rough and full of jokes and jibes. They called him Goatherd, of course, because he was gauntish, but they didn't go further than that. He was as tall and strong as the 15-year-olds, and quick to return either a good word or a jeer. So he made his way among them, and even that first night began to live as one of them and learn their work. This suited the ship's officers, for there was no room aboard for idle passengers. There was little enough room for the crew, and no comfort at all in an undecked galley crowded with men and gear and cargo. But what was comfort to Ged? He lay that night among corded rolls of pelts from the northern isles, and watched the stars of spring above the harbour waters and the little yellow lights of the city astern, and he slept and waked again full of delight. Before dawn the tide turned. They raised anchor and rowed softly out between the armed cliffs. As sunrise reddened the mountain of Gaunt behind them, they raised the high sail and ran south-westward over the Gauntish sea. Between Barnisk and Torhaven they sailed with a light wind, and on the second day came in sight of Havnor, the great island, heart and hearth of the archipelago. For 3 days they were in sight of the green hills of Havnor as they worked along its eastern coast,
but they didn't come to shore. Not for many years did Ged set foot on that land, or see the white towers of Havna Great Port at the centre of the world. They lay over one night at Kembermouth, the northern port of Way Island, and the next at a little town on the entrance of Felkway Bay, and the next day passed the northern Cape of O, and entered the Abavda Straits. There they dropped sail and rowed, always with land on either side, and always within hail of other ships, great and small, merchants and traders, some bound in from the outer reaches with strange cargo after a voyage of years, and others that hopped like sparrows from isle to isle of the inmost sea. Turning southward out of the crowded straits, they left Havna astern, and sailed between the two fair islands of Ark and Ilion, towered and terraced with cities, and then through rain and rising wind began to beat their way across the inmost sea to Roke Island. In the night, as the wind freshened to a gale, they took down both sail and mast, and the next day, all day, they rowed. The long ship lay steady on the waves and went gallantly, but the steersman at the long steering sweep in the stern looked into the rain that beat the sea and saw nothing but the rain. They went southwest by the pointing of the magnet, knowing how they went, but not through what waters. Ged heard men speak of the shoal waters north of Roke, and of the borrowless rocks to the east. Others argued that they might be far out of course by now, in the empty waters south of Camery. Still the wind grew stronger, tearing the edges of the great waves into flying tatters of foam, and still they rowed southwest with the wind behind them. The stints at the oars were shortened, for the labour was very hard. The younger lads were set two to an oar, and Ged took his turn with the others, as he had since they left Gaunt. When they didn't row, they bailed, for the seas broke heavy on the ship. So they laboured among the waves that ran like smoking mountains under the wind, while the rain beat hard and cold on their backs, and the drum thumped through the noise of the storm like a heart thumping. A man came to take Ged's place at the oar, sending him to the ship's master in the bow. Rainwater dripped from the hem of the master's cloak, but he stood stout as a wine barrel on his bit of decking, and looking down at Ged, he asked,
"Can you abate this wind, lad?"
"No, sir."
"Have you craft with iron?"
He meant, could Ged make the compass needle point their way to Roke, making the magnet follow not its north, but their need. That skill is a secret of the sea masters, and again Ged must say no.
"Well, then,"
the master bellowed through the wind and rain,
"you must find some ship to take you back to Roke from Hort Town. Roke must be west of us now, and only wizardry could bring us there through this sea. We must keep south."
Ged did not like this, for he had heard the sailors talk of Hort Town, how it was a lawless place, full of evil traffic, where men were often taken and sold into slavery in the South Reach. Returning to his labour at the oar, he pulled away with his companion, a sturdy Andradean lad, and heard the drum beat the stroke, and saw the lantern hung on the stern bob and flicker as the wind plucked it about, a tormented fleck of light in the rain-lashed dusk. He kept looking to westward, as often as he could in the heavy rhythm of pulling the oar, and as the ship rose on a high swell, he saw for a moment over the dark smoking water a light between clouds, as it might be the last gleam of sunset, but this was a clear light, not red. His oarmate hadn't seen it, but he called it out. The steersman watched for it on each rise of the great waves, and saw it as Ged saw it again, but shouted back that it was only the setting sun. Then Ged called to one of the lads that was bailing to take his place on the bench a minute, and made his way forward again along the encumbered aisle between the benches, and catching hold of the carved prow to keep from pitching overboard,
he shouted up to the master, "Sir, that light to the west is Rogue Island."
"I saw no light,"
the master roared. But even as he spoke, Ged flung out his arm, pointing, and all saw the light gleam clear in the west, over the heaving scud and tumult of the sea. Not for his passenger's sake, but to save his ship from the peril of the storm, the master shouted at once to the steersman to head westward toward the light. But he said to Ged,
"Boy, you speak like a sea master, but I tell you, if you lead us wrong in this weather, I'll throw you over to swim to Roke."
Now, instead of running before the storm, they must row across the wind's way, and it was hard. Waves striking the ship abeam pushed her always south of their new course, and rolled her, and filled her with water so that bailing must be ceaseless, and the oarsmen must watch lest the ship rolling should lift their oars out of water as they pulled, and so pitch them down among the benches. It was nearly dark under the storm clouds, but now and again they made out the light to the west, enough to set course by, and so struggled on. At last the wind dropped a little, and the light grew broad before them. They rowed on, and they came, as it were, through a curtain, between one oar stroke and the next, running out of the storm into a clear air, where the light of after sunset glowed in the sky and on the sea. Over the foam-crested waves they saw not far off a high, round, green hill, and beneath it a town, built on a small bay where boats lay at anchor, all in peace. The steersman, leaning on his long sweep, turned his head and called,
"Sir, is this true land or a witchery?"
"Keep her as she goes, you witless woodenhead. Row, you spineless slave sons. That swill bay and the knoll of Roke, as any fool could see. Row!"
So to the beat of the drum they rowed wearily into the bay. There it was still, so that they could hear the voices of people up in the town, and a bell ringing, and only far off the hiss and roaring of the storm. Clouds hung dark to north and east and south, a mile off all about the island. But over Roke stars were coming out one by one in a clear and quiet sky.